You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight we have a double-decker here for Ian Graham Leask talking with David Bax, the editor of Private Wilderness, the journals of Sigurd F. Olsen. The personal diaries of one of America's best-loved naturalists reveal his difficult and inspiring path to finding his voice and becoming a writer. In the last part of the hour, Leask talks with Kristen Hemingway Janes, the great-granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway. Wow. About her book, Ernest's Way, an international journey through Hemingway's life. Ernest's Way is a guide and literary exploration into the cities Hemingway visited and lived in, both as they are now and as they were when he graced them. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
David Backus, are you there?
Yes.
Ah, good. Hello there. So, David Backus is waiting to tell us all about A Private Wilderness, the journals of Sigurd Olsen. And let's see, Sigurd Olsen's biographer. 2015, David retired as a professor of journalism and mass communications at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Welcome to Right On Radio, David Backus.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You sound like you're a long way away. Could you talk up a little bit into your microphone?
Yes. Okay. Is that better?
A little bit. I've got my engineer here shaking his head. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Sigurd Olsen's work.
Well, it goes back a long time. I did my master's degree research on one of his conservation battles that he was in. That was way back in the early 80s. And then my dissertation was a history of the Canoe Country, Minnesota and Ontario. And so that was 88. And then I was hired at UW-Milwaukee and I started the biography, the research for it in 1990. So it's been, you know, it goes back 40 years or so.
That's really interesting. Just to make sure that we're familiarizing all of our listeners with Sigurd Olsen, let me just read the little blurb or bio about him that's on this lovely book by University of Minnesota Press. It says, Sigurd F. Olsen, 1899 to 1982, introduced generations of Americans to the importance of the wilderness. He served as president of the Wilderness Society and the National Parks Association as a consultant to the federal government on wilderness preservation. He earned many honors, including the highest possible awards from the Sierra Club, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Isaac Walton League. The first of his many influential books was The Singing Wilderness, 1956, and that is reprinted by the University of Minnesota Press. If you are interested in that, that was the book that first got me interested in the Boundary Waters and wilderness tracking and all of that kind of stuff. And I expect that was similar for you, David, was it?
Kind of. My family took us on a bunch of vacations when I was a young child to beautiful natural parts of the country. And in 1963, we wound up in Ely and discovered how much we loved it there. So we started going up there every summer. And my parents bought the Singing Wilderness at some point. And I think I was second half of high school, maybe, when I read it for the first time. And I really loved it.
And are you an aficionado of the lakes up there and paddling?
Yes, I took nowhere near the amount of journeys as Sigurd Olsen or some of my friends, but I've had some great experiences in the canoe country.
We could waste a lot of time talking about our experiences up there, I'm sure. So the main thing about this book is that this is the diaries, and you've gotten hold of his private diaries and edited them, printed them. And what's so interesting about them is that you kind of emphasize on the interstice writing that you do, the actual writing, his writing style and what he tries to do with the work. Tell us a little bit about why that interested you, having originally been his biographer.
Well, it took him a long time to figure out how he could write the things that were most deeply touching to him. And it was a big struggle because he felt this sense of calling, really, to write the kinds of things he eventually became known for, those essays that touch at people's hearts. They capture so well the emotions that people feel when they're outdoors and connected with nature. But that was not an easy sell for many, many years. And so he tried other things. He wrote hunting and fishing stories for Outdoor Life, Field and Stream, Outdoor America, you know, those kinds of magazines. And became actually, by the 1930s, he was kind of a regular and so fairly well known among people who read those sorts of outdoor magazines. But that wasn't what excited him. That wasn't what really interested him. And he had this sense that he had to find a way to write full time. And meanwhile, he had become a teacher up at Ely, first at the high school, and then after he got his master's degree, he was a professor at the junior college and eventually a dean. Well, all during that time, while he was teaching, as much as he knew that he was good at it, the students enjoyed him, it wasn't what he most wanted to do. He felt this need to write. And so trying to figure out how he could write what he felt called to write and also make enough income to support his family, that was a major struggle. So he had, because he had spent his summers guiding people in the canoe country, and a lot of the people who took guides in those days, the 1920s, were fairly well off. They could be doctors, they could be lawyers, prominent writers, you know, that kind of thing. He became friends with some people who were reasonably successful writers, and they said, if you want to be able to write full time, make enough money to support your family, you have to write short story fiction. So he tried writing nature related short story fiction for the Saturday Evening Post, the Atlantic, all kinds of popular national magazines. And he was terrible at it. He got scathing rejection letters almost every single time. But he was driven so much to succeed at writing. He tried that type of writing at least now and then, off and on, for 20 years. But meanwhile, he dabbled in the kinds of style that became his hallmark. And editors and some agents who he consulted with, they said, yeah, this is really nice writing, but there's no market. And so it was endlessly frustrating for him, and therefore through him, for his family as well.
all BWCA lovers and wilderness lovers, of course, should read this book, because here you're coming out with his private diaries, and you know, we see him experimenting with writing and trying to find different rhythms and focuses and things like that. How did you get access to these diaries?
Well, that began with Elizabeth Olson, probably in my grad school days, but really for the biography, I had access to everything. His diaries at that time, some of it was at the Minnesota History Center, but the bulk of it was at his home. When I started the research for the biography, I spent one solid week in his writing shack going through his diaries that were kept in metal filing cabinets out there. But I was disturbed because I saw references to beginning his diary as early as 1930, but the earliest that I could find in his writing shack was 1937. So I wondered what had happened to those. And I spent the next 3 years continuing the research, and I had reached the point where I thought, well, I have to start writing. And I told Bob Olson about it, and he happened to be at the house right then, because Elizabeth had gone to a nursing home, and he and his wife, Fanny, were cleaning some things out. And I said, well, I never found those journals, and I just have to start writing. And he said, well, I just found them. He said they were in a cardboard box at the back of a refrigerator, an unplugged refrigerator in the basement. And so that gave me the full set. And I photocopied all of them. And so I had the idea even then that it would be great eventually to do this book. But once the biography was done, the remaining things that had been at the house were divvied up between the Minnesota History Center and the Wisconsin State Historical Society, and those journals went to Wisconsin. And they had a restriction on them that prevented publication of any sort until I think 2018. Yeah, I think it was a 20-year thing. And I thought, well, eventually maybe I'll be able to do it. I kind of forgot about it, but in 2019, I think it was, the state archivist for Wisconsin called me, and he said the permissions had ended. He had talked to Bob the previous summer, and Bob said, "Yeah, that's fine. It's time to let them be fully open." And meanwhile, Bob had died, and the archivist asked me if I'd be...
Slow you up there a minute. Tell us who Bob Olson is, and you just said that he died.
Yeah. Bob is one of Sigurd and Elizabeth's two sons. He's the younger of the two. The other one was Sig Jr., and Bob and his wife, Vani, spent their final quarter century or so in Elizabeth's childhood home, just outside of Hayward, Wisconsin. Mm. So Bob and Vani, being so close, relatively close to me, they became like second set of parents. So when this became open, and then the state archivist said, you know, would you be interested in doing a book on this? I had all of the material just waiting for me.
And you had already read it though, right?
Yeah, I had used all of it and quoted from it quite a bit in the biography, but I knew that there was so much more there, and that people could get a different view of him. I mean, it's one thing, I wrote his biography. That's my looking at all of the evidence from his life and interviewing people, all his letters, his articles, his journals, etc. And me writing as best I can a story that shows who this person was, who he was over the course of his life, who he became. But that's different from reading what he wrote in his journals at the time he's going through stuff, and he doesn't yet know whether he's going to succeed or not, or what he's going to become. And so I think it's valuable for people who are, especially anyone interested in Sigurd Olsen, to read the journals as well as the biography. You'll get a better sense of the intensity of the struggle he went through to become who he became than you could simply from reading the biography, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's not only for people who love nature, who love Sigurd Olsen. Both the biography and the journals, to me, are a great example of someone who had the sense he had to do something, and all he went through to make it happen. And the key thing is, he never gave up. And I know as a professor, my students were so worried so often about whether they'd be able to become who they felt they needed to become. There's so many pressures on them, economic pressures, social pressures. And I used Sigurd Olsen in my classes with them as an example of someone who faced those pressures and showed that it is possible, even though it's not going to be easy, to keep going even when you feel you can't.
Yeah, well, that's very good teaching, I think, to lay a pathway for students and, you know, for young people. It's quite interesting for me that it seems like yesterday when I was first reading about him and all of this, I really didn't read much of his. I didn't know about the journals. And, you know, when you talk about him writing about nature, and I was digging into some of the work that you've published here, it did remind me quite a bit of Hemingway. And funnily enough, we've got Hemingway in the next segment here. His granddaughter is going to be talking to us about Ernest's Way, her new book, Kristen Hemingway Janes. And in preparation for today's work, reading the Sigurd's journals and, you know, looking at some of Hemingway's work, you know, Big Two-Hearted River and things like that, it was serendipitous that the two interviews would take place simultaneously, but that's sometimes how it works. It's really interesting.
Yeah, right.
And several of the pieces of writing that he did really caught me like that. Particularly the one that you put in near the end where he's out in the snow and he hears a truck off in the distance and he's kind of in the spirit of it. He's there in a kind of spiritual, I don't know what you'd call it, almost a trance. And this truck going by at a distance breaks the spirit, and he waits for it to leave and then tries to re-enter that and can't.
Right.
And that moment really brought tears to my eyes. I've had that feeling before, you know, and it made me admire him even more. You know, probably because he's more like me than I thought he was. But, I mean, it's that sort of sense of connection to somebody I felt really powerfully.
Yeah, and it was those moments of connection that he most wanted to write about and pass on to people. But it was important to him personally, too, obviously. And when it was shattered like that, it was a challenge. Interestingly enough, he wrote in his book Listening Point, sort of the centerpiece of the book is a chapter called The Whistle, in which he's out at Listening Point and he's in that moment again, and then he hears a train off in the distance, and his first inclination is to get annoyed. But the essay ends with him reflecting on the meaning of the whistle as well as the wilderness, and how his appreciation of wilderness also depended on things symbolized by the whistle. And that striking that balance was important to him.
Yeah, it's interesting how a train whistle in the distance feels like the wilderness to us to a great extent. We all feel that sort of connection to it, and we don't mind being woken up in the night by that sound, do we?
Right.
It's very odd. So he started writing in the 30s, nearly 90 years ago. It seems strange to me to think that it's that far back, and he dies in the early 80s. I remember when he died, I was living here by then, and was very sad about it, obviously. It's odd, and you know, we're all growing older, and now you've retired. How did working on those journals affect you emotionally in terms of how you yourself are growing older and coming to the end of one career, and you know, what are you going to do next?
Yeah, I tell you, it was interesting because I read them initially when I was in my early 30s, which is around the time period that he's writing most of them, 30s and the early 40s for him. And when I first read them, I thought I'd get frustrated. I thought, can't you see what it is you have to do? And when I came back to them a couple of years ago, and now I'm in my early 60s, and I had not read them in between, and so I was able to approach them fresh, and I realized I'm much more forgiving now when I read them. And I had gone through 30 more years of stuff myself, and I could appreciate it without getting annoyed by him. But boy, he did have a hard time listening to himself, I think.
Yeah. So this book's not just the printed diary entries, but it's also a lot of pics. You must have needed permissions for those, and they're very well placed. Checking through his life and the rest of it, did you have to sort of select those carefully? Was there a lot of
pictorial? Some of those I provided, but the family gave me so many years ago. But most of them were located by my editor, Christian Chvetin, and he did an amazing job. I mean, he went to the usual places, such as Listening Point Foundation, you know, a couple of people who were connected to the Olsons who would likely have some. But he, this was during the pandemic, so he couldn't just go around to archives. But there's so much that you can find online now, and he has access to all of these national archives, Forest Service archives, Minnesota, Wisconsin. So he found tons of great picks.
Yeah, yeah, and they are very evocative of the times. And that face that he has, I'm surprised there isn't some artwork, with something with his face and the landscape. Is there anything that you know of out there?
I have seen, I think, at the Sigurd Olsen Institute, some artwork. I know they have a bust of his head there. But I know there was at least one print made at some point or other that shows him with a background of nature. I don't recall what that was all about, though.
Well, it's interesting that the title for the book that you guys chose, you and your editor and the press, a Private Wilderness. I always think that kind of really depicts the inside of a person's mind, you know.
Right.
And it struck me here. I wonder, was there anything in the entries that you're uncomfortable with?
That I'm uncomfortable with?
That you didn't print, or that you felt uncomfortable printing?
Oh. There wasn't anything that I felt I should exclude because of, it being like too personal, or
okay.
that it would make people uncomfortable. Really, when I chose what to include and not to include, I mostly got rid of repetition. He had so often wrote the same kinds of things about how he has to get out of this, he has to find his medium. It sometimes even the same phrases, whole sentences appear over and over. And so you'll see repetition in the book as it is, but there is actually a lot more in his journals. And I cut out parts sometimes that dealt with things that I didn't think were as important, such as some of the specifics of the financials. They would be interesting for sure, but I don't know how meaningful they would be. And I was trying to keep the most important stuff into a one volume possibility.
And you certainly did that. You write about his belief and use of primitivism and religion, spirituality, his influences, Wordsworth and Thoreau, and wonderful chronology at the back of the book. And the one thing I just want to bring up that you wrote about, and this is him writing about hunting. He says, hunting, 5 a.m., not so much the hunting as what goes with it. And I love that. That's why if I ever go hunting, it's not because of the hunting, it's because of what I find around me in the wilderness.
Right.
Yeah, so it's wonderful. And you've done a masterful job of putting this book together. I really congratulate you.
Thanks. For me, it was truly something I had always wanted to do. It was fun to do, to dive into that again. And I'm really glad that Minnesota Press does such a fantastic job. They've done 4 of Sigurd Olsen-related books now with me. And I can't say enough about them. They are wonderful people, and they put in such great work on the design, on marketing, everything.
Yeah, well, we love them. We're out of time, unfortunately, David. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you've just been listening to A Private Wilderness, The Journals of Sigurd F. Olsen by David Backus. Thanks so much for being on Ride On Radio, David. Hope to see you again.
Okay, thank you.
And now this. Kristen, are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Just about. You sound like you're a long way away.
Oh. Well, the computer's right in front of me.
All right, well.
You were very quiet, too.
We'll do our best.
But I have my volume up all the way.
All right. So we have Kristen Hemingway James, and she's here to speak with us about Ernest's Way, an international journey through Hemingway's life. Hemingway James is an American author originally from Seattle. Beginning at a young age, Kristen began to explore America, first on road trips with her mother, traveling from Seattle to Key West, then on her own by bus and train. The American landscape with its roadside cafes, strip malls, and wanderers features prominently in her fiction. She is the author of the short collection The Smallest of Entryways, and is currently working on a novel based on her travels, as well as a new short story collection. This book, Ernest's Way, is a kind of travelogue on steroids. Welcome to Write on Radio, Kristen Hemingway James.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's very good to have you here. We've had a number of your family on the show over the years, so it's good to have you too. Tell us about why you followed in your great-grandfather's footsteps to write this lovely book.
Well, it started out, I was doing pieces for a virtual tour of the different cities, and I was writing about Paris and London, where I was living at the time, and I just thought, this would make such an amazing book if people could have this book physically with them when they went to these cities. I'm just a book person, and so I felt like having a book would be so much more enjoyable than just being on your phone all the time. Plus, then I could write sort of a backstory and have some biographical stuff along with it. So I just thought, I can't believe no one's done a book like this. And I was really excited to be the person who could do that.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
I'd already been to several of the cities, and it was just wonderful to sit there in London and write about all these different places. It was really, truly like traveling to them for me.
And had you been to most of them?
I had already, yeah, but I'd already been to a lot, so I had some anecdotes and experiences in them, and then, you know, I did a lot of research, obviously, an enormous amount of research for the book.
I wanted to ask you about the research versus family stories and what, you know, what's been handed down. That fascinated me, you know, talking to you a few weeks ago about all of this. You know, just to get a sense of how a relative of an icon like Ernest Hemingway, a descendant, how much sort of came down to you in terms of family stories, and how much you had to research, and what the tension was between those two ways of looking at him.
Well, yeah, it's all kind of mixed together, because I grew up starting to go to the Florida Keys when I was about 7 or 8, and Ernest's brother, Lester, was still alive at the time. So I not only got to experience Key West back in, you know, the 80s, when before the festival had even started, and going to all the haunts just naturally with my family, but I was also doing that with Ernest's brother. So I mean, I was just immersed in the family stories from the time I was a kid. And so when I went to, say, Paris, for instance, you know, my uncle had been there before me, spent time having adventures there. So there was just so much of it that I had grown up hearing about. So they were very delightfully mixed together. And I got to relive them talking with my cousin Hillary about it. And it was just a kind of a natural thing. She has some anecdotes that I mentioned in the Key West chapter about some of the parties that we had in Key West when I was growing up, which were just phenomenal and just like some kind of story that you would read. I mean, it was just fascinating being with people who had boxed with Ernest when he lived there, who were still alive. I mean, it was just back then, it had only been not that long since he had died. So, I mean, less than 20 years since he had died. So mm-hmm. He was still very much, felt like he was alive in the lore of Key West back then. So it was a combination of stuff I'd grown up with, stories that we retold to each other as I was writing the book. And then the research mainly came in just with historical facts about places, dates, addresses, things like that. But I felt like I had a sense of how to write about these places just sort of naturally.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's loads of things that crop up in the book that felt to me like they would only come from a family member. You know, I'm doing some of that sort of work myself and my great-great-grandfather, and the family stories handed down seem to be the ones in some ways that have the most ring of truth to them and the usefulness to them.
It was fascinating to learn about things that I never knew about, because I didn't even know that he had spent time in London and that he had spent time in London with his brother during World War II. Mm. And I didn't have any of the backstory about Toronto, which actually was probably the most fascinating chapter for me, because it was so integral to his starting out as a writer, because he was writing journalism, and some of the stories that he was writing for the Toronto Star ended up being the beginnings of stories that, like the Nick Adams stories and stuff. So yeah. It was so fascinating to me and so valuable to me to learn about his craft going back to Toronto and just learning he ended up there and just the places there. I mean, it was, that was fascinating to me. And I felt like that was a really valuable valuable chapter that I got to do, because not a lot, a lot of people even talk about Toronto, but it was so important.
And that came through the research.
Yes, yeah. It came through the research. Wonderful
really
book.
Interesting. His brother, Lester, very few people know anything about him. He wrote a novel too, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. It's got trumpet in the title. Sound of the Trumpet.
Sound of the
which
Trumpet.
I actually haven't read, but I was just talking with his daughter, Hillary, who I'm going to see next week, about Sound of the Trumpet. So it was her father who wrote it, yeah. Lester. And I'm planning on reading that.
And his daughter's name is? What's his daughter's name?
Hillary.
Oh, that,
well,
that's
he has
Hillary.
Two daughters.
Oh, that's your cousin. Yes, that's right. Okay. You know, there's quite a lot of you now, and it's hard for me to keep track of how many are and where you all are. It's very interesting, and it's so funny to look at pictures of you all. There's nearly always a family resemblance going back to Hemingway himself, of course, but also his mother and father. Do you guys notice that?
Oh, gosh. I was just talking to Hillary today about that, because she was talking about her daughter, and I was saying, and her daughter sings, and I was saying she inherited Grace, who is Ernest's mother's singing voice, because Grace was an opera singer and taught voice lessons. And I said, she looks like Grace. I just said that today to Hillary.
Funny. It's funny how those genes go down. Yeah. Go ahead.
She said she thought that she had my smile, and I thought that was really sweet. But people tell me that when they see pictures of Pauline, they tell me that I look like Pauline. So
yeah. There's a picture on the book, very nice book, by the way, very well put together, published by Pegasus Books. And that picture, it definitely has a resemblance. You know, I guess I can see Hemingway in you, and now you mention it, Paul, would it be Pauline, or would it be is it Pauline that you're connected to, or
yes, his second wife,
his Pauline. Second wife, yeah, that's right,
my great grandmother.
Yeah
I was thinking, because I'm writing a biography of Ernest's mother right now,
yeah,
because there isn't one, and so I was like, well, I enjoyed writing that other one, and Grace is an absolutely fascinating person, very talented painter and singer, and so I'm writing a book about her, and I was thinking I should put a family tree in the beginning.
Absolutely. I think you should do that, because there's a lot of you working, and you know, I've had several Hemingways on the show, and there's, you know, academics and editors and writers and everybody, and it sometimes it's a little bit hard to keep track of who you all are and how you're all connected. It would be really good to have a family tree in the next work
you do
about this.
Ernest's youngest son Gregory, my grandfather, had a lot of children.
How many did he have?
I think in total it's 9.
Wow.
He had 4 wives. He had children by 3 of them. So
that's the youngest, Gregory. And we've got some pictures of him in the book here. There's some lovely pictures in here too. They're really, really nice. And a lot of them seem to have come from the collection, the John F. Kennedy collection. How did you work with them to get these, many of these photographs?
Well, they have a wonderful archive online. I communicated with them. I was actually there for the dedication of the Hemingway part of it, the Hemingway room, when I was in high school. But yeah, they have a really lovely, lovely archive that people can peruse online that just have so many photos and reproductions of diaries, because Grace, Ernest's mother, kept this incredible diary for her children, little, you know, writings with Ernest's handwriting when he was in high school. And I mean, it's really wonderful. So you don't even have to physically go there. You can look online.
I found it very moving to look at him elderly and to look at him young. Does that strike you the same way?
Did you say elderly and young?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he aged way too fast. You know, he wasn't very old when he died. He was only 61, so he looked a lot older than he really was when he was in his late 50s.
Yeah, but he kind of gets to me sometimes. And my dad died about the same time, and pretty much of the same sort of thing. You know, heavy drinker,
yeah,
and the rest of it, and very, you know, very dodgy, and kind of losing his way a little bit. And it's just always strikes me what would we have if we'd had another 20 years of Ernest Hemingway? And of course, we do get.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote Old Man and the Sea very late in his career, and it's one of his most amazing works. So, yeah.
Tell us a bit about some of the posthumous work. Let's see. We had who was it that finished True at First Light, which was posthumously published. One of the sons finished that?
That was Patrick.
I think it was Patrick finished it. What do you know about that?
I actually haven't read True at First Light. I've read Garden of Eden, which was published after he died.
I loved Garden of Eden. which is your favorite of his books?
Sun Also Rises is my favorite. Probably Farewell to Arms is probably second. I thought the part where he's actually on the battlefields and going on the train and Farewell to Arms, I mean, I just felt like that feels like a memory to me. Like,
it's that's right.
So vivid. Mm. It's just incredible.
Farewell to Arms is my favorite. I've read that several times, and every time I read it, it feels completely different. And one of the things that your book did for me was to remind me how young Ernest Hemingway was when he actually went through those experiences. You know, of course, he writes about a character who is, you know, kind of a lot wiser. But you get the sense from the character in the book of someone much older. And of course, he was only, 18?
He was 18, yeah.
Yeah, very,
he
very
actually
young.
turned 18 in Italy.
Yeah.
So I think he was 17 when he first went over.
Is he wounded at age 18? All right. Some of those stories.
I think it might have been right before his 18th birthday when he was wounded.
Interesting. I love
I
love that story about the. About recovering in the hospital room, in another country.
I just read that recently.
And the beauty of that, and the quietness of the prose in that, and the opening paragraph. I think he wrote over and over again, 40, 50 times. Are you? Particularly interested in any of his short stories, because you write short stories yourself.
Oh yeah, I love the Nick Adams stories so much. Big Two-Hearted River is so wonderful. Indian Camp is so, it's just absolutely freaking. I mean, I'm rereading Marceline, his sister's book at the Hemingways right now, and she describes in great detail. There are times at Walloon Lake and just all these wonderful details about their family life that you just don't get, you know, anywhere else. And that the feeling of him being outside and being with nature and all the things that he learned from his father and all those summers that they spent at Walloon Lake just come through so vividly in his short stories. I mean, it's just beautiful. I've always loved his short stories.
Have you been influenced by the style?
No, I don't think so. It was hard because when I took creative writing in college, I really didn't have my own voice yet. And it just takes so many years to develop your own voice. At least it did for me. But part of that probably was because I was self-conscious about it because of him. because I'd read him, and probably he's so, it's so strong when you read his stuff, and he's got such a reputation for a style that I'm sure subconsciously I was trying to sidestep it, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And it just takes a really long time to develop your own style. You just have to write and write and write and just figure it out. And finally it happened. But I think with him, it was, he kind of had just a clean slate, you know? He didn't have an Ernest Hemingway before him, so.
Well, obviously this, loads and hundreds of books out there about how he developed that style, and it probably does develop, as you say, in here in Paris, or as you in sort of.
Well, I think in Toronto. I mean,
you think it happens Toronto. With the newspaper style, yeah?
And the cablese that he was writing too, when he was a war correspondent, in Paris, when he was traveling from Paris.
But you can also see the influence of Gertrude Stein on that,
that
simplicity that he wrote with. Yeah.
And, the journalism but you writing do, and then Gertrude Stein. That's exactly right.
But you do have, I noticed a clarity that you strive for in your style too, and sometimes just a sentence or an idea pops out, just how you wrote about how distraught he was after leaving his first wife, Hadley, even though he's with his second, Pauline. And that brought me up short. Just, he gets such a bad rap for being kind of, in many ways, you know, the kind of macho, over-the-top ubermensch. But here's this incredible sensitivity that is, I think, all the way through his work.
Oh, he was so sensitive. I mean, from the time he was a child, he was both wise and sensitive. I think it was his incredible sensitivity. I mean, I talk about it in the book, but he was trying to deal with that incredible sensitivity his whole life, which I can completely relate to.
me too. And I'm a big bruiser of a guy too, and it sometimes people don't understand that you can be both things.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to deal with. And he was in a war when he was a kid. I mean, he was traumatized when he was 17. So from then on, he was, I mean, you know, Big Two-Hearted River is about that. A lot of people don't realize that story is about the war, really.
Yeah.
He never once talks about the war, but he was just forever changed, and going back to this place that had been so innocent and wonderful for him as a child, and was now completely different because he'd been in Italy.
Well, it does. Yes, that's one of my favorite short stories of his too. And of course, that's where he really perfects the so-called iceberg effect. You know, when he's in the second part of it, when he doesn't want to go and fish the dark, swampy part of that river. Amazing. And never does write directly about it. Do you use that technique when you can? When it's appropriate?
Well, we were taught that in school, you know, even before I ever read him, because I didn't read him until high school when I read Sun Also Rises. And we were taught back then. I mean, I've heard from someone recently that people don't teach that anymore, but we were taught to show and not tell.
Yes. Yes.
So that was just sort of how writing was taught when I was in grade school. And I remember in fifth grade or so, maybe fourth grade, they were teaching that. And I thought, something just clicked. I thought, wow, that's really amazing. That's something I want to do. That's really great, you know, because it allows the reader to be a participant, and it accesses the subconscious and allows the reader to sort of make the story along with the writer.
Exactly.
And also in their own interpretation. So, I mean, it's just brilliant. It's because you're trying to connect with people when you write. And so it's just a way to do that on a more deep level.
It was one of the things that happened with that story, Big Two-Hearted River, when I first read it, and you know, I was a bit younger and hadn't been to any classes that taught me any of these techniques, and it wasn't even, I had no idea what was going to happen in the future, that I'd end up a publisher. Very strange. But I remember when I first read it, I thought, what is going on with this character, Nick? What is happening, and what's going on here that is like me? He felt like me, mm-hmm. on his own by a river, catching hoppers, seeing black squirrels. And it really struck me, and it's an extraordinary thing to really identify with a character like this. And yet, in our time now, excuse the pun, he's often denigrated for some of his work and some of the behavior that he displays. And I think it's fairly clear that that's coming out of trauma, coming out of a certain kind of sensitivity, that nobody seems to be checking their anger and understanding. Is that something that bothers you?
Yes, it does. I know it's difficult to separate, the person, the whole person from the art, a lot of times. And I understand that. But it's really unfortunate, because there are some really beautiful things that people, when they're just looking at the stereotype, or they're just hearing things about him that are total generalizations, are going to miss. And I think he's still really valuable as an instructor for writers. And I hope that doesn't get lost in the future, and that people continue to learn from his writing.
Well, we'll try to keep that alive and keep the positive part of this alive and well. On a fun note, what happened to his cats? Are they still the descendants of the seven clawed cats down there in Key West?
Well, really, I think his cats were mainly in Cuba. They did have at least, I think, Snowball they might have brought from Key West. The legend is that the six-toed cats at the Hemingway House are descendants of his cats. That is what I grew up with. I grew up spending a lot of time at that house. Mm. I did one time bring a cat that was not six-toed over the wall of the Hemingway House, and she ended up spending the rest of her life there, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
So I put, another kitty in there, but I don't think that she had any kittens. But it is fun to go to the Hemingway House and see the six-toed cats.
Yeah, it is. And what a lovely experience. I was lucky enough to do that. And I was lucky enough to be at Ketchum this May with my son, and went and saw the grave and paid my respects.
Yes, go to the Hemingway House. It's a beautiful place.
And just after that, I met you. So good serendipity. Very interesting.
Yes.
So we are out of time, Kristin. It's lovely to have you on the show. I hope you'll come back with your new writing when it's published.
Thank you, sir.
You've just been listening to Kristin Hemingway Jane speaking with me, Ian Graham Leask, about Ernest's Way, an international journey through Hemingway's life. Thanks so much for being on Write on Radio, Kristin.
Thank you.
See you soon.